worry, doubt, fear. These are all mindsets that shrink the perception so we don't see opportunities. We see blockages and hindrances and obstacles only, and then develop a kind of a coping mechanism or a defense mechanism to live with our own perception. It's called being in jail. It's called imprisonment.
Hi everyone, Drew Prode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. For today's interview, I want to introduce you to someone that has been a guiding light in my own life for many years now. And that's an individual named Dr. Reverend Michael Beckwith. With all the recent deaths that have taken place and the conversations on systemic racism, we wanted to invite somebody who we truly look up to host a layered and deep and thought-provoking conversation on all things systemic racism and inner growth. And the two of those are linked, you're gonna see in this interview. Dr. Reverend Michael Beckwith is the founder of the Agape International Spiritual Center. And for 34 years now, he's been servicing both the Los Angeles community and the global community. People tune into his sermons at his spiritual community. It's a trans-denominational community headquartered here in Los Angeles. And if the words God are not something that you incorporate, or if you are very religious and you do identify by your tradition and faith, you'll find that Reverend Michael Beckwith, his teachings are something that fit for an atheist, somebody who's a devout Christian, somebody like me who's grown up in the Hindu and the Jain tradition, but doesn't identify by either of those, but knows that there's something bigger that's out there, and doesn't often know the languaging to use to identify that thing that's there, but I feel it inside. So don't let the fact that it's a reverend be something that turns you away from this conversation. In fact, I think he's the perfect person to come in to our podcast and help us look at what's happening both from the macro and the micro. I think you're really gonna enjoy this conversation here. A little bit more about Dr. Reverend Michael Beckwith. As I mentioned, he's the founder and spiritual director of Agape International, which is a community that's here in Los Angeles, comprised of thousands of local members and live streamers. And you can watch the live stream sermons. In fact, this one that he did last week that we're going to be linking to was really profound and touched me in a beautiful way. His teachings are regarded for being incredibly transformative, helping people develop inner peace by using practices such as meditation, affirmative prayer, life visioning, a process that he coined and came up with. His teachings and work at the Agape International Spiritual Center bring to the world and help them take the everyday practices that they incorporate into their lives to make the world a better place. In 2012, Dr. Beckwith addressed the UN General Assembly during its annual World Interfaith Harmony Week. That's a big accolade. And as the co-founder and president of the Association of Global New Thought, he hosts conferences all around the world featuring incredible spiritual teachers who come in and share their wisdom, including His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. Three of his most recent books, Life Visioning, Spiritual Liberation, and Transcendence, are recipients of the prestigious Nautilus Award. Dr. Beckwith has appeared on Oprah's network, Super Soul Sunday, Dr. Oz, CNN, Larry King Live, Travis Smiley, and his own PBS special, The Answer Is You. So without further ado, I'd love to jump into this incredible conversation with Reverend Michael Beckwith. I hope you're going to enjoy. Here we go. Hi, everyone. Drew Prode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, I want to talk to you about my favorite go-to meal. It's a huge, healthy, hearty salad. And the key is I never get bored of it because I'm constantly mixing it up and I'm including a lot of colors, a lot of layers, and a lot of textures. I'll give you an example. Just the other day, I made one. I took arugula, butter lettuce. I took fresh basil, mint. Then I added things like nutritional yeast, red onion, avocado, watermelon radish, wild-caught sardines, cucumbers, a seed blend, and roasted chickpeas. And then I mix it all up. I pour it on extra virgin organic olive oil and a little bit of Primal Kitchen dressing, which I love. And I served it up. Everybody loved it. It was a hit. Now, the key is I get all these condiments from Thrive Market delivered to my door so I don't have to think, and I can mix up my salad every single day. I can order all the pantry ingredients I use in my daily salads, like wild caught sardines, salmon, olive oil, hemp seeds, hemp oil, beans, and lentils, which I don't do a lot of, but I love to throw in every once in a while, clean dressings, nuts, and seeds. And again, I get them delivered to my door so I don't have to think of it, and I can vary my salad every single day. Thrive Market has thousands of products, including gluten-free, dairy-free, organic, paleo, fair trade, vegan, whatever you're following right now, they got that ingredient for your type of diet. And also, they have toothpaste and skincare products and non-toxic cleaning products for incredible prices, which are great if you want to keep your home clean during these times. They also, bonus, carry grass-fed beef and sustainable seafood options. It's so simple to plan ahead with Thrive Market and get all those items delivered to your door so you never feel bored of your favorite go-to meal, which I hope you'll try my salad out. If you join Thrive Market today, you'll get a $20 shopping credit when you place your first order. Any order above $49 ships for free. And because sustainability is a huge thing that Thrive Market cares about and we care about, and I know you care about too, everything ships carbon neutral from their zero waste warehouses. That's freaking huge. Now, if you're interested, just go to thrivemarket.com/brokenbrain to sign up and start filling your cart up today. You'll see the discount automatically applied when you go to thrivemarket.com/brokenbrain. So one thing that I know after years of experimenting with my health is that a morning routine is key to start the day off. How you start the morning sets the tone for the day. And one thing that I've been doing in my morning routine, besides setting an intention, playing with meditation, reading something inspirational, is I mix up the days of when I have coffee. And I go and I turn to something that doesn't give me jitters and doesn't make me shaky and gives me the energy and creativity that I need to focus. And that's Four Sigmatics ground mushroom coffee with lion's mane and chaga. Again, I mix it up. I don't always have coffee because I don't always need coffee and I want to mix it up. That's why I drink Four Sigmatics ground mushroom coffee. Lately, my favorite way to mix it up is to blend it with a little bit of warm almond milk and add in some cinnamon. Now, here's the thing. You hear mushrooms and you think immediately, okay, mushrooms are not tasty. Now, the thing is, I promise you, Four Sigmatics ground mushroom coffee tastes like a rich, delicious cup of coffee. It tastes like coffee. You won't even know the mushrooms are there. Now, Four Sigmatics has lots of different blends with therapeutic mushrooms in it. Their ground mushroom coffee that I've been loving and enjoying has lion's mane to boost productivity and creativity, and chaga to support the immune system, which we all know is super helpful to do right now. All of Four Sigmatics products are vegan, organic, and gluten-free. Every single batch is tested by a third-party lab for heavy metals, allergens, bad bacteria, yeast, molds, mycotoxins, and pesticides, because these things are in other products that are out there. Four Sigmatics tests for it to make sure that you and I don't consume it, because we want the cleanest ingredients possible. And no worries if you don't love it. Four Sigmatics has 100% money-back guarantee. I'm excited to share an offer with my Broken Brain audience from Four Sigmatics. And here's what it is. From now through June 28th, Four Sigmatics is having their biggest sale ever of the year with savings up to 50% off. Plus, Broken Brain listeners receive an extra 20% off with the code BRAIN, B-R-A-I-N. If you've been curious about medicinal mushrooms, Four Sigmatics beverages blends are the way to go to improve your own health. Okay, if you want to take advantage of this offer, all you got to do is go to foursigmatics.com/brain. That's foursigmatics.com/brain, or use code BRAIN at checkout to get your medicinal mushrooms today. Reverend Michael Beckwith, as you always say, peace and blessings to you, sir, and welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Drew, thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure to be with you.
You know, it's an honor to have you here, especially, you know, during these times. We reached out to your team before some of the recent events that have happened. And when we had heard back that, you know, you had the willingness and the time for the interview, we were really excited because I've tuned into Agape over the years. You know, I moved to Los Angeles about 9 years ago. And through a mentor and a friend, I was introduced to the Agape community, and I've had the chance to visit your Culver City location before you moved over to Beverly Hills and tune in live regularly. And I've forwarded your videos and your sermons to many people in my audience and friends because I found them to be an incredible guiding light during a time of a lot of heaviness for so many. So I just want to acknowledge you and thank you for that. I also want to check in and send my condolences because I know in addition to the weight of the world that everybody's feeling right now, and especially people of color and the Black community are feeling right now, you also lost somebody in, I believe, the Agape congregation you had mentioned in your sermon this past week. So my condolences. So first, always want to start off by just checking in and with my guest, how are you doing during this time?
You know, interestingly, I'm doing well. I feel a great degree of spaciousness within myself. And at the same time that we're surrounded by such intensity, I do feel spaciousness. And I think that has something to do with my spiritual practice and an inner awareness that progress is being made, an inner awareness that things are unfolding. So I'm not blind to anything that's going on. And I think, you know, the things that are being revealed now to the world is something that I've lived with all my life. So it's not that I've gotten used to it, but it's nothing new to me. You know what I mean? The racism and things of that particular nature. So the spaciousness is there. The sense of gratitude for being alive is here. The sense of enthusiasm for the next stage of unfoldment for myself and for the species is here. It's all there. So in other words, I'm feeling good.
And I want to just piggyback off of that because I think even for a lot of people to hear somebody say that they're feeling good during the challenging times and the recent deaths of unarmed Black men that, you know, we've been witnessing, there's a sense of even spaciousness and peace that I even hear hearing somebody else saying that they feel good. Like, it's almost like, is it okay to say that we feel good during this time and balance that in one hand and also the weight of everything that's there and the awareness of everything that's there?
Right. You know, it doesn't deny what's happening in the world. It doesn't deny what's happening to people of color. In order to build the kind and just global society of which I'm seeking to do with my community and my evolutionary collaborations, we have to be the vibration of the community that we want to build. So through meditation and visioning and spiritual technologies, you build up to a level of gratitude, and that gratitude is independent of circumstances. It's not that I'm grateful that everything is going well, and it's not that I'm grateful when things are going bad. I'm grateful because that's in my field. It's in my vibration. So I can say I'm feeling good. I could say it this way. I could say I'm feeling good in spite of the things that are going down. But I'm not going to allow the things that are going down to pull my vibration down. Now, it has put me into shock. I have shed tears. I probably have cried more in the last 3 or 4 weeks than I've cried in a number of years, seeing the death of George Floyd and seeing the death of Ahmaud Arbery. And, you know, I've cried over that. And then I have to come back to myself and ask, what is it that's mine to do to uplift the field, to create a vision, to create strategy, to create movement? So I can't succumb to it and allow hate or revenge or just an overwhelming sense of stagnation to take over my life. I can't do that. I won't be any good. So in saying I feel good, it's not that I don't know what's going on. I know exactly what's going on because, as I said earlier, you know, I've been Black a long time. and so the things that people are now seeing, other than the people of color, you know, a lot of people are shocked by it, but we've known it for a long time and experienced it for a long time and had to live with it for a long time and be able to cultivate a sense of unity with the presence, a sense of joy, a sense of love, a sense of creativity, generosity, resourcefulness, innovativeness in the midst of all of that, you know. So that's where I'm coming from.
You know, piggybacking off of that, there's this theme that you've been using for the month and you introduced this phrase that a lot of people, I think when they first saw it, they're like, okay, what does he mean exactly? And I saw it this weekend for the first time in your lecture and in your sermon to the Agape community, and you said, the apocalypse is here. So tell us, what do you mean by that? The apocalypse is here.
There are many meanings for the word apocalypse. A lot of people have embraced the word apocalypse as the end of the world. And it is. It's the end of a worldview. It's an end of a paradigm. You know, first of all, let me say that what the world is not the planet Earth. The world is a set of beliefs and perceptions and opinions and points of view that people agree upon. So individuals live in a certain worldview. And we're looking at the end of a worldview, the end of a world. Another description of the apocalypse means lifting of the veil. And so whenever a worldview is ending, there's a veil that's lifted, and there's a deep sense of transparency that occurs where you have an opportunity to see things that previously were hidden. So we're living in such a state right now. End of one worldview and seeing what has been hidden from the eyes of many people. So when you look at the spark plug, the spark that was ignited when George Floyd was killed in public view, you look at the videos of Ahmaud Arbery being killed by two supremacists, and you can go down the list, but just the recent ones, and then suddenly there is incremental protest movement that takes place that not only goes to the United States, but goes all around the world, where people are saying, no more, we have to deconstruct racism, we have to provide justice for all people. What was hidden was that systemic racism had been here for a long time. It's systemic, it's built into the culture. And heretofore, people not of color would think that people of color were like either making excuses or exaggerating, or no, that didn't really happen, you're getting it wrong, this is an exception to the rule. You know, now it's revealed, and people are beginning to see, oh my God, this has been happening systematically. Unarmed people have been killed systematically. People of color have had a different kind of justice than other people for years. I mean, all the way back to the end of slavery, it's been a different justice system and a different way of being in the world for people of color. So that's no longer hidden anymore. It's like, here it is. Now, it's not that it was hidden. I mean, it was hiding in plain sight. And many people knew about it, but many people weren't involved in the deconstruction of it or looking at themselves to see how they're participating in it. And when you go all the way back, I don't even know if you were born then, but you go back to when Lyndon Johnson was president, and they did something called the Kerner Report. And they did a complete study of African Americans in America from the time, there was a time in the Constitution where a black man was a 3/5 of a man. It was written into the Constitution. And then amendments obviously happened, and now we get to be fully human in the eyes of our own Constitution. But they examined black folk in America up to that moment he was president. And the Kerner Report revealed that based on the racism, the bigotry, the segregation, Jim Crow, public lynchings, last hired, first fired, just the whole way that black people had been living in America, Kerner Report said that we as a people should not exist in America. There's no way we should have survived everything that has happened. We should have gone the same fate that many of our Native American brothers and sisters have gone. They're almost wiped out, you know, and those that are here, living, many of them are living on reservations with terrible health care, terrible food, terrible opportunities. But the Kerner Report went on to say, not only have we survived, but we have excelled in almost in every structure of our society: music, athletics, education, science, medicine, innovativeness, creativity. And there was no explanation for it. It was like, they should be gone, but here they are, and they're thriving. So again, the report shows that what's been going on is not, hadn't been hidden, just that people just weren't interested. You know, it's just like, you know, now there's no hiding it.
There's no hiding it. No, that's so true. And I think that it's the combination of being able to look at history, understand where everything came from, feel the anger and outrage that people are feeling, and just how, you know, as you mentioned, people of color, Black communities, they've known this has been going on for a long time. It's a lot of other people that are finally maybe figuring it out or seeing it, or it's coming to the surface. I just even saw today, like, you know, Aunt Jemima, like on the maple syrup, and the company's coming out saying like, yeah, like, this isn't cool. Like, we shouldn't be perpetuating this stereotype. You know, it's like people.
Ben's rice.
What was that?
Uncle Ben's rice.
Uncle Ben's rice.
And that used to be a joke. When I was in junior high school, I went to an integrated junior high school, and so there was, you know, issues there. And they would say, "Ain't your mama on the pancake box?" I mean, that was like a racial slur that people would say.
Right.
So yeah, it's been going on a long time.
It's been going on a long time, and. You know, you started this series on Instagram, and you've been working it into your sermons where you've talked about lifting the veil. And I really resonated with that because in my background of in my Hindu Vedic background, you know, I don't identify that, but that's a tradition that I came from, Jain Hindu Vedic background and teachings. We have this term called Maya, and Maya is the veil of illusion, the veil of illusion from that prevents you from seeing the truth that's around you. And we're seeing some people awakening to the truth and saying, wow, I never knew that this existed. Other people are seeing that truth and saying, you know, doing everything they can to combat it and double down on their contribution to the systemic racism that people are facing. What do you think gives you, you know, inside of your spiritual teachings and traditions, how do you think that that gives you a different perspective on the matter? Because not only are you understanding the history of where we came from, your experience as a Black man in this world, but also the lens of spirituality. What do you think that triage gives you when it comes to looking at what we're going through today?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, it gives me a vision of possibility. Like my spiritual practice has opened me up to seeing differently. From my first awakening, I could see that we were surrounded by a universal presence of what I called at that time love, beauty, intelligence. It's very real to me. It's not like a belief system or something I studied or memorized or went through the holy books and came up and gave my subscribe to a belief system. I had a direct encounter with the presence that I've had many times, even as like 2 weeks ago, I was engulfed in the brilliance of the light to the point where I was blinded in this world for a while. And so I have that, which allows me to see the great possibility that lies within every single human being. So it gives me a deep sense of purpose and a deep sense of seeing where we are going as a species. That's real to me. That's not conjecture. That's not theory. That's not happy talk. It's very real. And then my experience on the planet, having experienced racism and bigotry has moved me to the point of kind of understanding the perpetrators. You know, I understand it's a sickness, it's a disease. When we're one race, you know, the human race, and though there are different ethnicities and different nationalities, there's really only one. So anyone who's in that myopic viewpoint, you know, they're living in such a narrow band of reality that it's now being labeled as a sickness, that your band is so narrow that you don't even see full reality or at least a large part of it, that you're sick. So when I see my sick white brothers and sisters, you know, there's a deep level of compassion that I have because they're honestly ill. That doesn't prevent from time to time an outrage or an anger from coming up, but it gets subsumed in the vision and the fact that these individuals are not in their right mind, for lack of a better word. Mm. So the spiritual practice has steadied me in a very, very powerful way, because I know that I have to speak, and when I'm doing my calling, I have to call a thing a thing. You know, I have to say what's there. I can't pretend it's not there. But at the same time, I have to speak about the possibility of where we're going with the love ethic, with, you know, the dynamism of each of us doing our inner work so well that we create a field of possibility. That's one of the things I mentioned the last couple of weeks, that a lot of what we're seeing right now has come about because individuals have been praying and meditating for years, because individuals have been creating a field that has pierced the noosphere, the mental atmosphere of the planet, and provided a context for a very high frequency to exist on the planet. So now things can be seen that were once hidden. So the prayer and the meditators didn't cover up stuff. It actually opened stuff up, you know. So I think I'm answering your question. So all of that comes together.
You answered Mighty Change. Oh, please. Sorry. Go ahead.
I said all that comes together for Mighty Change, mighty moments of transformation. I think we're in the midst of a tremendous moment of transformation. Everything is malleable. Everything is fluid now. Things, the status quo is moving. You know, you have police reform. You have individuals moving towards justice. Racism is how you feel about me. Justice is how you treat me. Those are two different issues. You know, but the justice system has been built upon racism to a large degree. So you see both of the status quo shaking and shifting now, and people pushing the needle towards the deconstruction of racism and pushing the needle towards what does justice look like for real, for all people, not just rich people, but what does justice look like for all people? Those questions are up now. And the people in the streets are saying, we want immediate change. Now, of course, it's going to have to be a vision, strategy, and implementation. It's not just going to come overnight. However, there has been a lot of shifting overnight. Police officers have been fired for abuse recently, for shooting people. I mean, the gentleman that was killed in Atlanta for parking his car, being inebriated, ends up dead. You know, the police officer was summarily fired, as he should be. Justice would call that he's actually arrested for murder, you know, and that we play this out in a legal system to see what justice should be for him. So there have been changes, and there are changes going on, but I would say that what's occurring right now is just a beginning. And one of the things that I mentioned last week I think is very important is that whenever there's a shift in paradigm, there's always a pushback from the old paradigm. That's what happens. Same thing that happens within us spiritually. You have an insight, you have a revelation, but then your old personality tries to pull you back into that small perception of yourself. Mm. Same thing happens at a collective level. We've had a shift, we're shifting, but the old paradigm is pulling us back. I mean, we've had 5 lynchings in the last couple of weeks of Black people, 4 men, 1 woman. It tried to say that one was a suicide, but you know, most people don't really believe that that's the way it is, but this is the pushback from the old paradigm. Our sick white brothers are killing people. And so we have to be vigilant and alert and understand it's going to be pushback, you know.
Yeah. And even on the, you know, what I love about your teachings, it's like, it's both for the macro and for the micro, right? Yes. So there was a powerful question and theme that you had on this past weekend's sermon. You said, history in the making, are you a participant or a bystander? Because right. As we witness this happening in the global, it's also happening in the local. It's something that we're all facing. Many of my podcast community and friends and family members, because you know, this is not just something that's an issue with white people. There's many, I'm a South Asian background, Indian background. There's a lot of South Asians that have very racist thoughts against Black people or people who are darker skin color. And it goes deep, you know, it goes deep, even if many of them were victims of their own racism or ideas or thoughts.
Right? It's an interesting sickness.
It's an interesting sickness. But I think it's important to call it a sickness because when we look at it that way and we understand our place in history, there's this feeling and understanding that when somebody is sick and there's a mental there's like an illness that's there, almost like a mental illness in a way, they need help. They don't need to be just squashed and canceled and thrown away, because you might post something for a lot of people who are watching here. They might've shared support on Instagram, on Facebook, or other stuff. Then that family member, that old coworker, that person from high school comes out of the woodworks and then they chime in with their thought or their link to some sort of other video or idea or thing that's out there. How do you share with people who want to be a participant and not just a bystander? How do we elegantly move through this space to be a part of that history towards a greater good, towards a possibility, while also maintaining a sense of equanimity?
There has to be a real interest. And I think this particular period of time that we're living in, I'm noticing that people are really interested, that the white people, many of them, are really interested not only in the experience of people of color or even our LGBTQ community as well, they're also trying to figure out where they've been unconsciously participating in it, you know, with white privilege, or, you know, and that there's a lot of layers to that. And so people are reaching out and asking questions of how do they participate in that. I shared a couple of weeks ago as an example, you know, one of our young men at Agape, a 15 years old white guy. Matter of fact, he's my godson. You know, he snuck and stole his mother and father's car in the middle of the night and went and picked up some friends of his. So there was like four running deep at night. Police pulled them over, asked him, you know, let me see your license. He didn't have a license. He's 15. And after a brief conversation, the police officer said, okay, go home, Sonny. Go home right now. Now, his mother, being an astute being, taught him that that was white privilege. That if he would have been four black people in a car without a license, they would have got fingerprinted and probably jailed for the night and got their first arrest record. But because he was white, the police officer just said, go home. You know, didn't write them up, didn't write a ticket, didn't do anything. So people are starting to get an understanding of the difference of how it is to live in America as a person of color. So I think that one of the things that I mentioned is that racism is not going to be deconstructed by black people. It's going to be deconstructed by white people. How they trace their, as you brought up earlier, how we educate our kids to be anti-racist, to be pro-human, to be pro-human beings. You can't just assume that your kid is going to grow up as a loving being. He's influenced by people he goes to elementary school and junior high school with, and the conversations that are in the locker room, when if he's an athlete, or in the classroom. There has to be a real education that this is honorable, this is civil, this is not. You know, if people engage in this kind of conversation around you, they're doing racial jokes, or they're putting down people because of the color of their skin, that's not okay. You know, you either have to speak up, or if it's too dangerous for you to speak up, you cannot participate. So I think that to just be a bystander and say, well, it's going to be okay, that's not the time for that. The time now is for education. If you're a parent, it's education. If you're with your friends and they say something ridiculous, education. You know, as an example, a number of years ago, before I started Agape, I spoke at a particular community. It was primarily a white church. They asked me to come guest speak, and I did. And after I finished speaking, they asked me, the congregation asked me to be their minister. And I said, I really don't think there's a fit here, you know? They really were pulling on me to be the minister of this church. And I said, okay, I'll go through the process, but I don't think it's a fit. So overwhelmingly, I would say 98% of the congregation wanted me to take over this community. There was a few people that did not. And they started something called a selection committee that you had to pass the selection committee before you went to the Board of Trustees. Now, the Board of Trustees was waiting to hire me. Selection committee was blocking it. And they started saying things like, I had never really graduated from college, from the school of ministry. If the property value is going to go down if they hire me, people are going to suddenly start parking their cars on the lawn. They started all of this stuff around me coming to this community. And what was interesting was that the people in the community didn't know. Everybody thought the person they were sitting next to them thought like them. So some white people were like shocked that they were sitting next to a racist. Some of the race people were shocked that they were sitting next to a person that loved everybody. They didn't care whether they're black or Mexican, straight or gay. And it created a tumult in the community. And eventually I said, you know what? You guys need to work your issues out. This is not where I'm supposed to be. The church split. It was a big earthquake, and the church actually split. And it became, it became uninhabitable. And they had to move to other location. They quickly hired a woman. And then that woman did something in her contract that allowed her to get a lot of money. She stole the money. I won't use the word steal, but she took a lot of money and left. You know, so everything they were afraid of happened, happened. but the point being, no one even knew who they were sitting next to until I showed up.
Yeah.
And so
it was the catalyst that unearthed it.
Yeah.
In a similar way, very different situations, but in a similar way in terms of the same result. It's like these situations are a catalyst for, in a way, it's revealing who's sick. Because many of those people, you know, former employee of mine, you know, I know them to be a loving individual, a caring individual, and was exhibiting some racist behavior on Facebook. But if you would go to that person and you would say to them, like, are you a loving person? Are you this? That person says that, yes, you know, I'm a loving person. A lot of people around them would know them to be a loving person. So it's that idea that, okay, there can be love in people's hearts. They could want to do good, and they may still have this one thing that's out of balance, that's out of the equilibrium, that's not in order, that's not supporting people. We don't want to condemn them and make them a bad human being forever and write them off. Doesn't mean that we have to participate in their nonsense if we so choose not to. Right. And there could be a good opportunity to educate them if the time, you know, if the opportunity came up.
Yeah. That particular experience, two things. One, a number of years later, after I started Agape, many of those people came to Agape and apologized. And I could tell it was sincere. They really had a change of heart about me, about African Americans, you know, gay people, because we had the first one, the first gay ministries in the city. And I did the first gay marriage in Los Angeles back in 1987, when it wasn't even legal, you know.
Wow.
And but anyway, the people came, they apologized, and they were sincere. And the good thing about it was I had already done deep forgiveness work.
Yeah.
That situation catapulted me into such forgiveness that I had no rancor at all. And it also catapulted me to start Agape. I said, you know what? I'm not going to put myself in that kind of situation again. I'm going to start a community. The base of the community were individuals from all walks of life, all ethnicities. I started my vision group. So the base of Agape grew from what I would hope that the beloved community would look like. Everybody was there in the room, in my living room. And so the Agape has that as a part of its DNA. You know,
one of the most diverse collections, and really reflects what Los Angeles and the larger world really looks like.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know,
so this idea of a participant or bystander is not just outward in action. It's also inward action, right? Are you going to be a bystander and let all the inputs of the different things around you put you into a place of worry, fear, and all the lowest, you know, vibrations that you talk about? I'd love you to expand that a little bit. What does that look like when we're thinking, okay, history in the making, are we a participant or a bystander, not just with what's happening out there in the world, but what's happening in our inner world, right? What are the ways that people inside, in their own inner, regardless of where they stand on the issues, where they're aware of it or not aware of it, what are the ways that we create our own violence and harm inside that make us, in a way, a bystander to our spiritual journey?
You're speaking like a true Jane. I can feel your essence of peace and ahimsa and in all of that. I think many individuals are living at the level of survival and pleasure. You know, they're surviving, doing everything. And then the next level that they're living is just trying to have pleasure in their life. And I think that if we're not going to be a bystander, we have to be what I call a growth-centric being. That is, we have to live to grow to the next level of our unfoldment. Most people don't live like that. They live, they want to get, you know, their retirement, they want their they need their money, they need their house, and then they want a little fun. But at some point, and a lot of times this happens because of a crisis, you know, we're compelled to grow. Now, if you're a growth-centric person, then you live in a state of inquiry. And that inquiry is, you know, how can I grow today? How can I be more of myself today? How can I unleash my gifts, talents, and capacities today? We have to live at that level. And the beautiful thing about that is the universe, through its law, will answer those questions for you. You will start to be moved into opportunities and possibilities that will allow you to grow. Some of those opportunities may be uncomfortable, may be uncomfortable conversations you have with people. You know, I've been involved with a number of podcasts and Zooms where the conversation was white privilege and people were examining themselves and how they've been participating. Or it may provide an insight where you get to look at yourself and say, whoa, I didn't know that was there. This is what's blocking my growth. Not just in the area of race, but just period, you know? So I think that when one begins to identify themselves as a growth-centric being, then with the state of inquiry, then you start to do the inner work. Of course, there's meditation. Of course, there's affirmative prayer. Of course, there's life visioning. Of course, there's fellowship with high-minded people. Of course, there's study. All of these are very important. But if you're living as a growth-centric being, the universe brings to you your next opportunity for growth. It shows up. And you have to deal with it. And if you don't shirk and run from it, you will actually, year after year after year, be a better version of yourself. You don't want to die the same person you are today.
In fact, because we're not always have that conscious awareness to being a growth-centric human being, we think sometimes of these things like prayer and spiritual practice and meditation as being kind of out there, but one way or another, we're practicing something. We're perfecting something. In fact, you used this phrase this past weekend. You said, you know, many of us have perfected the practice of worry. And we can see in the absence of a lot of this practice, spiritual prayer, meditation, you know, people finding what that is for them, in the absence of that garden, that beautiful garden, that ecosystem we create inside, the weeds will grow. And one of those weeds that you talk about a lot is worry. You know, this can be a very worrying time, even for people who are trying to do the good work and raise awareness and protest. They may be stuck inside internally in a place of worry that things are getting worse and better and lack,
right?
Because they've perfected that worry.
Right. You want to be prudent and safe, but you don't want to be worried. You don't want to live in the consciousness of worry. One of the things, what I said was, to add to what you're saying, is it's not that practice makes perfect. It's the practice of perfection that makes perfect. And people they have practiced their worry and their doubting and their fearing so well that it's become the frequency that they live in. So what prayer does, we're not praying to a magical man in the sky or anything like that. What prayer does is hone your awareness towards a feeling of connection with life. The presence, that's never an absence. So the worry dissolves. It doesn't take away discernment. It doesn't take away guidance that, you know, you're not going to put your hand on a hot stove or do something silly to hurt yourself. You're just not living in the consciousness of worry. Worry is like, it's mentally rehearsing what you don't want to happen. You know, so you're actually emotionally and mentally rehearsing the very thing you don't want, which helps bring that about. And so definitely worry, doubt, fear, these are all mindsets that shrink the perception So we don't see opportunities. We see blockages and hindrances and obstacles only, and then develop a kind of a coping mechanism or a defense mechanism to live with our own perception. It's called being in jail. It's called imprisonment. Mm. Stuck in Maya, you know, in life, which is so beautiful and so magnificent, you're not participating in it. I mean, we live in this oceanic brilliance everywhere. I've seen it over and over again, and people are unconsciously choosing to live in a little fragment of reality when all of this is available. Worry shrinks your perception, and gratitude and appreciation and love expands your perception, and your perception determines your experience. You know, it's all on us at the end of the day.
I want to just chat briefly about your story. When you think about that expansiveness, that awareness of awareness, and how big life can be in the macro and the micro, when people ask you how it all got started for you, what do you share with them? What was your first sort of witnessings, whether you were conscious of it or not, that life is so much bigger and that God isn't just a singular, you know, human being in the sky that we have to pray of? You know, actually, I just tell a quick story and I'll come back to the question. After I had a chance to meet you for the first time through a mentor of mine who introduced me to Agape, Serrano Kelly, you know, had introduced a group of young men who were volunteering and helping with a fundraiser for Agape. And I remember a couple years later, I saw you on Oprah, and you were with a panel of a group of individuals. And I remember this quote that she had pulled out from one of your teachings. And she said, you know, my favorite quote that, you know, you share is that, you know, God made man in his own image, and man has been trying to repay the favor ever since.
Right.
And I just thought that was perfect. You know, I thought that was just like a excellent quote. So yes, tell us, where did things get started for you? Where did this moment of awakening that even started this journey happen?
You know, I had my adult awakening in my last year at USC as a psychobiology major. But when I woke up then, I looked back at the younger versions of Michael, and I could see where that opening had always been trying to happen, but I had continually blocked it in order to be normal. You know, like when I was 11, my family's from Washington, D.C. We were visiting family. It's around my birthday. And my grandmother sent me to this grocery store. I went to the grocery store. I was in one aisle, and I could see, suddenly I saw in my mind, the person next to the next aisle who was stocking baby food was about to drop baby food. I ran around and caught it. Mm. And he said, how did you know I was going to drop it? I couldn't explain it. I'm 11 years old. I couldn't explain how I knew. I'm on my way back to my grandmother's house. My mother, my grandmother, and my uncle are on the stoop looking at me. And I knew I wasn't my mother's child, my grandmother's grandchild, or my uncle's. I knew I was something else, but I didn't know what that was. I'm 11 years old. So I had to make a choice. As I got closer and closer to them, I remember thinking, am I going to stay expanded, or am I going to shrink to be their version of me? And I remember shrinking. I consciously became I became the expectation of what my mother wanted me to be as a son, nephew, grandson. Same thing happened a couple other times in life. So in USC, I was having a series of spiritual experiences, but I was labeling them pathological, because at the time, we didn't have transpersonal psychology. We didn't have all of these teachings that we have now, you know. And so I thought I was going crazy, and I wouldn't tell anybody what was happening. It was like, I'm leaving my body. I'm traveling, astral traveling, having all kinds of experiences. So anyway, it culminated with, I'm in a lucid dream, and I was stabbed in the heart by a man. Two men held me down, one stabbed a knife in my heart, and I died. Pain was excruciating, physically and emotionally. When I woke up, that's the first time I could see as an adult that we were surrounded by a universal presence of love, beauty, that everything animate and inanimate objects were shining and glistening and glowing with luminosity. Everything was bright and beautiful. The love I felt was just beyond anything I'd ever experienced before. Now, when I got out of that box, I could never get back in. In my younger versions of myself, I would pop out, but I would find a way to get back in and be normal. But when that happened, I never could get back in. So that's when I went on a research and discovery quest to discover what had happened to me. And that's when I bumped into the mystical teachings of Jesus, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, the Dhammapada. I started studying all of the sacred paths and kept bumping back into this mystical awareness of oneness. And I was still deemed as weird. And for a long period of time, because this world had very little meaning to me, I had to reintegrate back into this world. I had to, you know, just like come back. And then subsequently, there's an integration process that takes place, where you actually integrate the higher frequencies into your daily life and into this incarnation. In the beginning, it was split. I could go to the exalted spaces, but it wasn't integrated. And then over the years, it became integrated, whereas I'm just a regular old human being. However, I'm integrated with a much higher frequency that's normal for me. You understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
I don't have to rehearse to be myself because I have access, you know, and it's very real. The spiritual world is as real to me as this chair I'm sitting on right now. And again, that's what gives me the faith, the hope, the gratitude. When you ask me at the beginning, how do I feel? That's where I feel good from. I don't feel good that someone got killed. I don't feel good that I and millions of people experience racism. I don't feel good that there's a lack of justice. I don't feel good that there's a lack of opportunity. That's not what, I don't feel good. I don't feel better because something good happens in my life. The good feeling is coming from a connection, you see. So really? As I said, I've been in the light a number of times. That reframes my awareness. 2 weeks ago was the last time. I'm telling you, I was in this office laying on that couch right there. When I woke up, I was blind. And I said to the person, the executive that runs my office, Lee, I said, I'm blind. I can't see. Mm. I was about to do a podcast. And she said, we got to call you back. We can't do this right now. And I could not see. All I could see was bright light just inundating my being. And then when I looked at her, I could see the fountain of light inside of her being. Mm. Like that. It's a fountain. And then one of my ministers came in and I could see the fountain. And then little by little, I could see this world, the wall, everything, and the light penetrating. And then my sight came back. But it leaves a residue of just an awareness that cannot be denied. I cannot deny what I've seen and felt. Mm-hmm. It's real. It's not like, oh, and the Dhammapada says, you know. Right. Upanishads, it tells us, you know, the Bhagavad Gita, God is everywhere. When you know, that's all true. But I've had my direct encounter with it. And
yeah. And you know, thank you for sharing those with us. And I think that a lot of people who are listening or watching today, they have their own versions of that. They've had.
Yes, they do.
They've had their own versions. And they struggle with the words to, you know, when people ask them, do you believe in God? What's your religion? What's your spiritual faith? Are you in or are you out, right? They want to use the words to have boundaries and define because that's the place that they're coming from. For those people that have had similar experiences, they're listening to your story and they resonate so deeply and they say, yes, you know, maybe I didn't have those exact experiences, but I've had things that are similar. You know, what is that called? What is that I can define myself as? What advice do you share with people who are looking for that container to encapsulate it within?
You know, just going back to the Bhagavad Gita, if you name it, you can't find it. You know, if you try to put it in a container, you start losing it. This is why I simply say it's a presence that's never an absence. I leave it there, whether you call it God or whatever. And what happens is, and you said something very important, many people have had an encounter like that, but many people aren't interested in it. They don't have a spiritual practice to integrate it, so it just becomes a memory. You know, 3 years ago, this such and such a thing happened to me, but it didn't get integrated. If you're a growth-centric being and you're building a spiritual practice, when an opening happens, you have the practice to integrate it into your life. So mm-hmm. It's not just a memory. It actually becomes embodied in you, you see. And many people, you can go down the list and talk to anybody walking down the street and say, have you ever had one of these kind of mystical experiences? Most people say, yeah, I remember the time when I was a little kid, this happened, or I was on the freeway. But their interest wasn't strong enough to actually research it, meditate, have a level of practice around it. So I'm always encouraging people, you know, to have some level of spiritual practice. Listen, I have atheists that come to Agape. Hmm. And so why do they come? They say that I teach life-enhancing principles. They don't even care about the word God. You see, I cannot deny that you're teaching that which is life-enhancing, and I want to practice that which is life-enhancing. And then they end up having an awareness of a presence. You don't have to put the name God on it. That's very, very real. You know, it's very, very real.
And to that flip side, for a lot of people who are listening, especially maybe some younger people who the word God might have traditionally scared them, is that, you know, people have, you've said it before, that people have tried to hijack the word God for years, right? Yeah. Can you expand on that a little bit more about how we don't have to necessarily be afraid of the word God?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, you know, we've been trying to remake God in a human image. And so oftentimes people have been teaching, you know, God is jealous. God has chosen people. God gets angry. The reason why we had a flood is because of homosexuals, or, you know, they put all of this human angst and emotion onto this presence. So that's called, or they'll teach things like there's an original sin, or there's something fatally flawed about you that, you know, you have to overcome. And that's called religious abuse. So when you combine religious abuse with trying to turn God into a human image, people want to run from that God. And I agree with them. You want to run from that kind of God. You want to fire that God and come to an awareness that you don't even have to use the word God. Or if you do use it, it has to be all-encompassing life that doesn't contradict itself, doesn't compromise itself. It's always the same being itself. And what is its main quality? Love. You know, God is love. Not sweet, sentimental, romantic love, but a total givingness without any sense of withhold. It's all conditional and unconditional. That's what life is. And we're growing to be able to accept that, receive it, embrace it, embody it. And we're on the planet to perfect our loving. So we're not just loving our family and our kin a particular way. Eventually, as we expand our awareness, we end up loving our neighbor. Not being in love with them romantically. It's a transpersonal love. That's why I can have a transpersonal love for a racist and still know that he's sick. You know, I can love a rabid dog, but not get in the way of being bit by it, you know? Mm. It's a transpersonal love that becomes very, very, very real. It's a figment of one's imagination.
Talk to us about sacrifice. What role does sacrifice play during these times and with our own inner work and outer work?
The word sacrifice means to make sacred. So when you hear someone say, you know, I sacrificed my time to finish college, I sacrificed my money to go to school, that means they made sacred those times that maybe they could have gone to a party, they could have gone to a bar, they could have bought some clothes. They made that time and money sacred by improving themselves, going to school, taking a spiritual class, learning to meditate. And so oftentimes sacrifice has been looked at, you know, as a law. I lost something for this. It actually means you made something sacred to actually gain a bigger part of yourself. So during this particular time, you know, we're asking people to sacrifice their time. That when the world opens up again, don't just run out of there and start buying a bunch of stuff. You're not a consumer. Don't just run out and consume or get caught back into materialism again or go out and just party aimlessly. You know, sacrifice your time. Study yourself. Ask yourself how you're going to grow. Allow this moment of COVID quarantine to actually be a sacrifice in which you're taking this time and making it sacred. You know, I can't go out and do all the things I used to do. What can I do? I've watched Netflix for 3 hours. Can I do something else? You know, what about pick up a book, an ebook? What about meditate? What about study? What about examining yourself? What about examining your own prejudices, your stereotypes, making it sacred? So I've said that George Floyd was a sacrifice, not a martyr. You know, we're not looking at his life as a pristine, beautiful human life, but his life has been made sacred because it was a spark plug for great protest, great self-analysis of a country, and a great beings around the world waking up saying, we can't tolerate this anymore. We have to do better as a human species. So his life has become a sacrifice, has been made sacred. There are people that would argue, well, he wasn't a perfect human being. We don't want to make a hero out of him. We're not. The people of color aren't making George Floyd a hero. You know, we're not making him a martyr. His life was a sacrifice to show the underpinning brutality, you know, of in the particular instance of a disgraced Minneapolis police officer, but in the larger context, policing in general, where people of color are concerned.
And as you've mentioned, the criminal justice system as a whole, you know, if you look at his, you know, there's been a lot of conservative commentators, which you were alluding to earlier, some who have been black who have said, this guy isn't a hero and the entire community is making it. It's like, well, we have to understand that even, you know, let's say he had a criminal record, but look at the first thing that he was arrested for. It was for a cocaine charge. We know that blacks, whites, and all races do drugs at equal levels, right? Black people don't do drugs at any more of a level than white people do. But they go to jail more often. And what happens when somebody goes to jail, if you know anything about recidivism, they're more likely to end up committing a crime. They're around other people. It's harder, not because they're a bad person necessarily, but because it's harder to get a job. There's other stuff, the community they're around. There's so many aspects of that versus, you know, let's say Brad or Tommy, who gets caught with that same amount of cocaine that happens, they don't end up in that same system. They end up with a slap on the wrist. And so that's how all these things can have cascading effects down the line. But I do appreciate your distinction there of, okay, yes, he's not a perfect person, but it's a sacrifice that's part of a larger picture. And it's what we're going to make out of the meaning of this situation to bring awareness to everybody.
Absolutely. Van Jones tells a story. He spoke at Agape one time, and he was sharing how, you know, he went to Yale, and he was noticing that when the guys at Yale got caught for drugs, you know, the fraternities or whatever, it was like boys being boys, you know, they got a little trouble, but not criminal trouble. And then right down the street, the black people who got caught with the same amount of drugs went to jail, you know, so the people in Yale didn't go to jail, you know. Boys will be boys. We're frat people that are in frat. The frat boys, you know, they have to get their marijuana. They have to get their cocaine. And this right down the street was different justice. And he talked about the fact that really opened his mind up to. I mean, he knew it already, but it really sure. Was a stark contrast to how one group of people are treated for the exact same thing, and how another group of people are treated for the exact same thing. And again, that's justice. Based upon economics and race, you know. So yeah. it's so sacrifice We want to make sacred our mind, our life, our money. This is why you give money to things that we're going to build a better society, things that you think are going to help in the world. That's a sacrifice. This money I could go use to buy a new suit or a new pair of shoes or whatever, but I'm sacrificing it. I'm making it sacred because I want to support something that's going to make the world better. So what looks like a loss is really a gain on a soul level and a gain on a societal level.
It's so key and it's so important because we can all then turn inward and these global problems, which will be there and are lessening. You know, the world largely, there's so much injustice, there's so much challenges there, but the world largely is improving compared to, let's say, 50 years ago, 100 years ago. There's still so many things that are wrong and we need to address those things, but things are getting better. And that hope and that internal work that we do and that sacrifice we make is part of that. This is, as you said, history in the making. We're all part of it and we can create a better world together.
Absolutely. We are evolving. It starts and stops. I mean, there is an evolution taking place. You think about what used to be legal, you know, and now there are like child protection laws where you can't just throw a child in a factory and work them all day. You think about what used to be legal. Women couldn't vote. Black people couldn't vote. Black people were enslaved. You think about what used to be legal. It isn't legal anymore. You see the evolution. Now we have to not only provide laws that are just, but the underlying attitude that has to shift as well. That's an educational and spiritual problem. And then the laws are a legal issue. And we have to work at both levels.
You know, there's a lot of comments, you know, to take us towards the end of our this interview. And I want to acknowledge you. You know, I know you've been a beacon for so many people, so the demands on your schedule are quite high right now with people wanting to interview you. So I appreciate you coming here. You know, there's a lot of talk right now of people saying, well, kind of like the battle with gun violence, you know, a shooting happens, everybody gets worked up, and then we go off into our own lives. And there's a big fear that's there that this the situations with these uncalled for deaths and racial violence that we're experiencing, that there has been some progress and there has been some things that have happened, but the fear that we just return, you know, to quote unquote normal, and the call for let us not return to normal. How do you think of that? And how do you, you know, talk about that to your congregation?
Are you talking about gun violence? Or are you talking about
just food? I was using gun violence as an example, but I mean racial injustice.
Nothing's ever going to be going back to normal in so many ways. We don't want to go back to normal. Actually, when we go back out into society again, we want these two pandemics, the COVID pandemic and the racial injustice pandemic that people of color have been living under, and they've been very intense, to actually allow that intensity to make changes internally on the micro and externally on the macro. So we don't want to go back to normal. We want to keep pushing the needle forward for great change. People have to, the COVID situation has taught people to basically take care of their health, cut sugar out of their body, make sure they have the minimum dosage of vitamin C, D, A, systemic enzymes, exercise, build up your immune system. You don't need a vaccine if in fact your immune system is potent. You know, people are learning that. And the COVID situation has allowed people to become more introspective, for those who are willing, and to make great changes in their life. And then this particular thing that was hidden from many people, the racism, the bigotry, the white privilege, we don't want to go back to the same society. We want society to now evolve as well. We want people, black people, to do their work so well internally that they no longer identify themselves as victims, even though they might be victimized. But they're not victims. They're actually luminous beings full of infinite potential. We want the white people to tap into their ancestral line of abolitionists, the abolitionists that stood up and said, and this can't go on anymore. We can't have a slave trade. We can't treat people this way. We want them to tap into their suffrage ancestors that said women can't be treated this way. Women must be allowed to vote. They must be allowed to go to work. They must be allowed to be creative beings. We want white people to tap into the abolitionist and suffrage roots and step up and help build a kind and just global society, walking hand in hand with Mexicans and Black people and gay people and all people. So we don't want to go back to normal. We don't want it to squeeze back to normality. And I think that we're looking at a movement, because this is the first time in history where even your mainstream media is not saying that this is a Black protest. You know, this is a protest and a visionary walk towards change by all people. Mm. You see, it's different. It's different than it's ever been. It heartens me to see. I'm not talking about the white supremacists that infiltrated Antifa and, you know, all of those people that created a lot of looting and stealing. You know, that was just a small part of the protests, and they weren't even a part of the protest. They were just there to create anarchy. But when you look at all of the white people, the Mexicans, you know, the Black people, the Asians, all on the street together, It's never happened before like this.
No.
Only time that's ever happened is at a Super Bowl. Everybody is split. I want my team to win. No, I want my team to win. And everybody's okay for a moment, whether you're Black, straight, gay, because you're voting for the team. This is the first time that out of sports, group of people came together and said, you know what? We need a different society. We need a better society. We can do better. America, we can do better. World, we can do better.
Lastly, Reverend Michael Beckwith, I want to, you know, I feel like for my Los Angeles tribe and community, I'm like one of those individuals that, you know, gets a chance to like pop in and pop out of Agape, right? And I want to, you know, every time I remember and can get a group of people together, I like to watch the live stream that's there and share it in the context of other people. And I find that your words and the songs, I just remember the day that I saw the very sad video of George Floyd's murder. I remember I went to Spotify on my phone, and just as I was processing everything, I was listening to the Agape spiritual choir. You know, it just gave me a sense of solace. It gave me a sense of just allowing me to feel the feelings that I felt, but having something to just be there with me that gave me solace. What do you want the larger, there's the work that you're doing, and there's also the work that Agape as a whole, as a community, is doing. What is it that you want to share about that work with our global audience that's here listening today?
First of all, thank you. Like you, they can tune in on Sundays at agapelive.com and get one or more of the three services that we do. I do a way of meditation service that begins at 6:45 a.m. Pacific time. Another service is at 8:30. Another service is at 11. Meditation service, and then a service at 11:30 and a service at 9. That's that offering. Every single day, we have a call for affirmative prayer at 8 a.m. and a call for meditation at 12 noon, facilitated by one of my teachers. So people are tuning in to keep uplifted, to keep inspired. Every Friday at 5:30, we have a community gathering. We have different teachers and different practices where people can go to Agape's Facebook page and talk and ask questions and be a part of how we can grow and build the beloved community together. I've just released an app. Individuals can go to michaelbbeckwith.tv, subscribe to the app, and then go to the app store, Beckwith Inspires, and get the app. And they can sign up for free. And I'll have points of inspiration there on a regular basis. So what we're seeking to do is build a consciousness. So within the community, we have different levels of service. We really believe that the rubber must hit the road through service. So we have sacred service Saturdays. We have ways that people can come in and serve other nonprofits. They can serve people who are elderly. They can serve people who are sick. So it's a full-fledged community that has a magnificent spiritual practice, but practice without service can be void. It doesn't mean anything. So it's a service community in which we want to take care of our, not only our congregation, but we see the whole world as our congregation. Hmm. And thus, thousands and thousands and thousands of people tune in every single week from all around the world to be a part of this energy. And they come in, people come in for retreats. They take classes online in order to better themselves, to allow their real self to unfold. So it's an all-encompassing community.
Mm, it's powerful. And there's so many offerings that are there and available to people. So I want to thank, you know, the Agape community for being, I think it's 34 years now.
In our 34th year.
34 years.
Our first service was November 30th, 1986.
Wow. It's incredible. It's just a staple here, not just in Los Angeles, but for, as you said, the greater community that's out there and all the live streamers, which I'm sure, especially during coronavirus, where people can't make it out to, you know, any kind of gathering that's there. I'm sure you guys have seen some incredible growth in tuning in, because as it is in difficult times, people need a voice, they need a direction, and they need a reminder around the spiritual practices that they can do internally and how they are a part of making history in the right direction, if they so choose to be. You've also been doing this incredible series called The Lifting of the Veil.
Yes, that's my Instagram.
Yeah, on your Instagram, and we'll link to the Instagram. Do you have more of those coming up in the future if the audience wants to tune in?
I did one recently with Tina Lifford.
Yep, saw that. It was beautiful. Yeah.
And India Ari was coming up again. We had a really good one with her before. It was so good, we had to have her come back. Mm. Van Jones has said yes to coming. It's going to be a number of interesting people that I'll be having beautiful conversations with.
Oh, that's fantastic. So we'll have a link to all that in the show notes. Dr. Reverend Michael Beckwith, thank you for joining us here today. And we appreciate your wisdom, your reflections, your teaching. And for you, giving a reminder for anybody who's listening, who's had these experiences, outer body experiences, these spiritual unearthings, these flowerings, as Eckhart Tolle talks about in The New Earth, you know, the first time the flower blossomed and you feel your own inner spiritual flower developing, and you needed that nudge or a reminder that you are something bigger than just what you see in front of you. Thank you for being that reminder for that community. I really appreciate it.
It's absolutely my joy. And thank you for this invitation to have this beautiful conversation with you. And if everybody's listening, God bless you. Keep your head to the sky, and life and love always wins.
Life and love always wins. Thank you, sir.